Welcome to Perimeter Church's Leadership Course on Baptism. This course is one of a series of four core leadership courses offered at Perimeter, including Theological Foundation for Leaders, Philosophy of Ministry, and Leadership Dynamics. This course is designed to delve into the scriptural teaching of baptism in the context of our covenant theology and is geared towards an intended audience of Perimeter members who have first completed our Theological Foundation for Leaders course. This audio series opens with an introductory testimony by staff pastor and teaching elder Bob Cargo on how he moved from a Baptist to a covenant position on baptism. Following Pastor Cargo's introduction, pastor and teaching elder Bob Burns teaches three additional classes following this general outline. The critical question of biblical interpretation, what does the word baptism mean, the question of baptism mode, and does water baptism save? This is followed by a question and answer session with the class. This series was recorded during the month of May in 2003.
I think Bob's asked me to share with you guys because he knows my journey of going from being Baptist to Presbyterian, and not only Baptist to Presbyterian in terms of membership, but in ministry too. To give you a little bit of the background or history for me, I grew up in a Baptist family. Was converted, received Christ as a kid. You know, when you grow up as a Southern Baptist in Alabama, your impression is there are more Baptists in the world than there are people. And that's because there are more Baptists on rolls of Baptist churches in Alabama than the population as a whole, you know. They never take anybody off membership rolls, and so there's Baptists all over the place. So, you know, my early years, I frankly probably had the impression that if you're a strong, good evangelical, you're probably Baptist, and people like Presbyterians and others are rather suspect, et cetera. And so I kept on going, and God then used First Presbyterian Church in Gadsden to sort of awaken me to Reformed theology in many ways. I first got involved with Campus Crusade's high school ministry when I was still in middle school. And through that, really began to grow more spiritually. The Baptist church I was involved with in terms of youth ministry basically had a youth choir, and that was the heart of our youth ministry. And that really didn't do a lot to help me grow spiritually compared to what I was getting in my involvement with Crusade. And the leadership at First Presbyterian Church in Gadsden had been some of the critical people bringing Crusade's ministry there in the late 60s. And so that became a relational segue to make it over to First Presbyterian Church. And so I began to get some influences of Reformed theology from that direction. And yet in terms of where my ministry was, I stayed within the Baptist world. Even as I wrestled through my college years with my theology and attended Briarwood Presbyterian in Birmingham some, my ministry outlet was Baptist. I was licensed to preach in the Southern Baptist, convention denomination. I was engaged in ministry after college, was employed in youth ministry first in Dothan, Alabama at First Baptist Church. And then when Bob Marsh went from that church to Second Ponce de Leon in Atlanta, I came and was on staff at Second Ponce de Leon Baptist in Buckhead as their minister to students, working with junior high school students, and college students for about a year before heading on to seminary. And so having gone to Samford University, had a lot of relational ties within the Southern Baptist Convention, had a lot of connections that way. Having worked at Second Ponce, there were relational connections, and as I was wrestling with where I would go to seminary, in a large part, do I just stay on the Southern Baptist track, or do I go to a seminary that I can sort of shop for my theology a little more? So I was thinking about places like Trinity Seminary and Gordon Conwell and others that, if you're not familiar with those, they're strongly evangelical seminaries, but you'll find a smattering of Baptists, Methodists, Presbyterians, you'll find Calvinists, you'll find Arminians, you'll find people that believe in dispensational theology, you'll find people that believe in covenant theology. Do I go that direction? Or do I follow some of my other friends to the PCA sort of down that road and go to RTS Jackson, where most of my buddies were going. And yet, as I was thinking through that decision, because of the relational connections I had in the Southern Baptist Convention, the president of Southwestern Seminary in Fort Worth, which is, by evangelical standards, huge. It's several thousand students, which is humongous for an evangelical seminary. The president of the seminary called to say, we'd love to have you out here. We want to, you know, sort of, you know, keep you in the flock, so to speak. And so for me, this was not a little thing to deal with a shift of theology. And to give you sort of the big picture, I ended up choosing Trinity Seminary outside of Chicago. At the end of my first year at Trinity, I accepted Calvinistic theology in terms of doctrines of salvation, what we call soteriology. At the end of the first year, I accepted the 5 points of Calvinism and believed in election and believed in predestination and all that stuff. But at that time, at the end of my first year, I had also taken, a little bit ahead of schedule, a class on ecclesiology and eschatology. And ecclesiology is the doctrine of the church, and involved with the doctrine of the church is not only church government, but also the sacraments of the church. Took an under fellow there named Paul Feinberg, who was dispensational. But part of what we had to do was choose a topic of ecclesiology or eschatology and do, I'm trying to remember now, was it, you know, 2,000-3,000 pages of reading, something like that, you know, just a gob of reading on a topic and write, you know, just a summary of what you've read. So I chose the doctrine of baptism. I was wrestling with this. So I got everything I could get my hands on and read and concluded that I was Baptist. And so my second year of seminary, I was officially, doctrinally, in a position of being a Reformed Baptist. I believe in, and then, you know, there are a lot of Reformed Baptists out there. They believe in 5 points of Calvinism when it comes to salvation, but they believe in immersion for believers only. C.H. Spurgeon is a Reformed Baptist. I mean, there have been some of the greatest lights of a banner of truth, Reformed preaching, a Reformed Baptist. And so there are a lot of those out there. Now, I was attending Willow Creek Community Church, so I never affiliated with a Reformed Baptist church. And during the year that that's where my theology was, it really irked me that most Reformed Baptists I knew of were tremendously negative in terms of the way they seemed to approach ministry, you know, and I never was attracted to the group, but that's where I was theologically. However, during my second year of seminary, the more I began to take more systematic theology and church history, those things had me thinking more and delving into things more that I, by the end of my second year of seminary, did come to embrace infant baptism and covenant theology's implications for infant baptism, and then really made the official switch into the PCA about the time I started my third year of seminary. And along with that, was engaged, interestingly enough, within a matter of 3 or 4 weeks after embracing Reformed theology on baptism, was involved in giving leadership to planning a PCA church. So that's probably the fastest switch of I know of anybody. You know, okay, I believe it, let's start a church. And a friend and I did that still somehow managed to exist in the near north side of Chicago and is continuing on. But that's a little bit of the framework of my story. Let me share with you also more internally. And for some of you, this may be a big deal in terms of you're here because you're wrestling yourself with whether you believe this or not. And you're here in this PCA church. You'd like to be able to embrace everything that it represents, but you're just, maybe you're like I was. For about a year, I was like, you know, I sort of wish I could embrace this, but I can't. I remember very well, I guess somewhere between my first and second year of seminary, I visited some friends who were going to RTS Jackson, and went with them to the little church they were attending in the Jackson area. Wayne Herring was the pastor there. Bob and some others here may know Wayne Herring. And it just happened to be that on the day that I visited, he preached on the doctrine of infant baptism. And, you know, I heard the whole sermon, and I just couldn't buy into it, you know. And I remember very well afterwards talking with him and just saying, I just, you know, can't really embrace this yet. He said, it's okay, you know. A lot of great people viewed it otherwise and on the other side of the fence. And, you know, if you see it, you see it, you know, whatever. And so I really wrestled with it. But let me share some things that made a difference in terms of my journey. And for some of you, you're probably here because you're wrestling with it yourself. I know because I know I see elders here that some of you are here not because you're wrestling with it, I hope, but because maybe you want to be able to, you know, explain it to others in a better way or whatever. But let me say the first thing that made a big difference in my embracing the doctrine of infant baptism is basically the lifestyle of people I saw that I came in touch with in the PCA. In fact, I wouldn't have come to embrace Calvinism or infant baptism or any of this if it had not been that I saw within people like, you know, Frank Barker and John Musselman and Randy Pope and a lot of other people that I met through them, a lifestyle committed to evangelism and world missions, and a belief in the inerrancy of Scripture that was firm, and an approach to the Scriptures that I could not deny was more thorough than what I got in my Baptist world. And that was huge. I never would have even tinkered with trying to even understand why people would want to baptize infants if it had not first been that I saw people in these churches like Briarwood and others, people that were passionate to share the gospel in leading people to Christ on a regular basis. And they were passionate in terms of world missions. And they were passionate about the Bible and very firm that it is God's inerrant, infallible word, you know. And the Baptists were waffling a lot on that. I thought, well, that attracts me to the PCA. And also a showing to me and demonstrating an ability just to go through the Scriptures and teach the Scriptures in a way that had depth. And the more I saw that, you know, when it came to this issue of infant baptism, I couldn't blow it off. You know, I couldn't just say, eh. I had to be willing to look at it. So the first thing I would say in terms of our ministry to others is that the whole big picture of things like evangelism and missions and the doctrine of Scripture, and just as people see us being serious about the Scriptures, you know, all those things are huge. So that's a critical issue. As I wrestle with it longer, I would say a key issue is this issue of covenant theology. In fact, the reason that after my first year of seminary, I did not embrace infant baptism is this. I had not delved deeply enough into systematic theology to be forced to grow on one side or the other of this issue of covenant theology or dispensationalism. I call infant baptism a second base issue. And the reason is this. You know, in baseball, you don't get to second base until you go to first base. And in our theology of baptism, it will never make any sense unless we first go to the first base of covenant theology. Until you really, really wrestle with and understand what covenant theology is, you will never embrace infant baptism. And a huge part of it is just how do we see the connection of Old Testament and New? And what are the issues of continuity and discontinuity from Old to New? And without that, a baptistic or a dispensational hermeneutic, a way of interpreting Scripture that has a huge divide between Old and New Testament, will never lead anybody to believe in infant baptism. And so we have to start there. One way of looking at this that for me was very important was looking at the issue of continuity versus discontinuity between Old Testament and New Testament. But, you know, last week Randy began to use a whiteboard, you know, in preaching and everything. I thought to myself, I could never do that because my handwriting will never be good enough. This isn't either, you know. This is only a faint hint of what these words might really represent. But at least if I say the words and write it, maybe you can follow along. Okay, a big issue is continuity. In other words, this is the question. Does the covenant given to Abraham and the promises given to Abraham continue on into the New Testament, and are they given to all Christians, or are they held for Israel alone? Now, that issue is just huge. Just the difference between a dispensational approach to the Bible or a covenantal approach to the Bible. The covenant given to Abraham, I will be your God and you'll be my people. Does that transfer to New Testament believers in Jesus, whether Gentile or Jew? Or is it the situation that God has that, you know, covenant with Abraham and with Israel, and what he's doing with the New Testament church is sort of a parenthesis? But the Abrahamic covenant is still for the nation of Israel and not for the church. And that's the critical question. And it really is huge. Everything else will divide or fall with that issue. Now, there are a number of passages that were very helpful to me, just sort of in a testimonial fashion. Let me list them, and then we'll get some of you guys to maybe read them for us. First of all is 1 Peter 2, 9 and 10. Let's just look at them. Let's just go through them and look at them together. And I don't know if anybody here has the New American Standard Bible. Anybody got New American Standard? Just sort of.
1 Peter 2, 9 and 10. But you are a chosen race, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a people for God's own possession, so that you may proclaim the excellencies of Him who has called you out of darkness into His marvelous light. For you were once not a people, but now you are a people, the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy.
Okay. Now, in the New American Standard, are there some of those words there that are in all uppercase? Yeah. Now, if you've done any study in New American Standard, you know that when you hit those words that are all in all uppercase, those are terms that come out of the Old Testament somewhere. Now, the interesting thing here in this passage is that all these terms, chosen people, royal priesthood, holy nation, people belonging to God, are all terms that are used for Israel in the Old Testament. So the point here is this, that Peter is writing to believers of the New Testament, and admittedly, he is writing primarily to Jewish believers. But he's writing to believers. Some of them are Gentiles. And he's saying, you guys, as Christians, as followers of Jesus, you're the chosen people. You're the royal priesthood. You're the holy nation. You are the people belonging to God. And when I first began to really get into this, I thought, that's huge. Because dispensational theology will say, no. Israel is still the chosen people of God. The church is the bride of Christ. But Israel are still the chosen people. Well, not according to the Apostle Peter. The Apostle Peter says, if you're a follower of Jesus, you're the chosen nation. You're the royal priesthood. You're the people belonging to God. And showing that this was God's intention all along in verse 10, he says, you were not a people, now you're the people of God. You had not received mercy, now you have received mercy. This was God's plan and God's intent all along. But that's one of those passages that says what God started with Israel, He continues with the New Testament church. And it's not a situation that God starts with Israel, then has a parenthesis with the New Testament church, and then continues again with Israel, which is basically the theology of dispensationalism. Mm-hmm. No, as we're going to see, not at all. We are not a nation in the sense of a political entity, but all that stuff in the Old Testament is figurative and representative language to give it to us in the New Testament to understand what it is to be the people of God. I mean, in terms of historically, we could say here, well, golly, holy nation, Peter's writing to followers of Jesus that are dispersed in a lot of different places, and yet he doesn't hesitate to call them the holy nation. So even though they're not gathered in a civic organization, a political national entity, he doesn't hesitate, to use that kind of language about them.
He's
writing to the elect.
And
very good. Why don't we just go ahead and to that right now, because she's already beat me to the punch on Galatians. There's another passage you want to look at. Let's look at Galatians 3, 26 to 29, and also Galatians 6, 16. In fact, the book of Galatians is a critical book on this issue, because Galatians is written very explicitly to deal with how do we understand the relationship between Jewish Christians and Gentile Christians, and who's in and who's out, and how do we put this whole thing together? Let me get you, if you're already there in Galatians, if you don't mind reading Galatians 3, 26 through 29.
Galatians 3, 26 through 29. For you are all sons of God through faith in Jesus Christ. For all of you were baptized into Christ, having clothed yourself with Christ. There's neither Jew nor Greek, there's neither slave nor free man, there's neither male nor female, for you are all one in Jesus Christ. And if you belong to Christ, then you are Abraham's descendants, heirs according to His promise.
Okay, now that's really explicit there. And if you belong to Christ, you're Abraham's seed. So, okay, who are the children of Abraham? Well, it's the believers in Jesus who are the children of Abraham. It's no longer those who just have a physical descent from Abraham who are Abraham's children. It's those who believe in Jesus who are Abraham's children. in Galatians really couldn't be any more explicit about this. It's really the picture that the seed, the chosen seed, becomes Jesus himself. All of that covenant theology comes to focus on Jesus as the seed of Abraham, and then those who trust in Jesus are part of the seed of Abraham. So it all becomes focused on him. And we don't have time to look at it today, but in fact, if you look at the Gospel of Matthew, Matthew is a fascinating study to see how all the promises of God that relate to Israel focus on Jesus. And Jesus fulfills all that Israel is. Israel in the wilderness for 40 years, Jesus in the wilderness for 40 days. Israel sent down to Egypt, in the prophecy being, "Out of Egypt I've called my son." And in the text of the Old Testament, it's very clear that's talking about the nation of Israel. God is saying of the nation of Israel, "Israel is my son and I'm calling my son out of Egypt." But Matthew doesn't hesitate to apply that prophecy to Jesus and to say, this is why Jesus had to go down to Egypt, be brought out, you know, "out of Egypt I've called my son," because it all focuses on Jesus. All the promises of the covenant, the seed, the promise of Abraham having a great seed, is all localized in Jesus. And then those who are followers of Jesus share in the promise. They share in the covenant. And this is another example of it here in Galatians. He goes on to say that, you know, that Jesus is the true seed. Another passage out of Galatians that's very explicit is Galatians 6:16. In fact, this will be a good one to read, both New American Standard and New International Version. Read verses 15 and 16, excuse me.
Galatians 6:15 through 16, New American Standard. "For neither is circumcision anything, nor uncircumcision, but a new creation. And those who will walk by this rule, peace and mercy be upon them, and upon the Israel of God."
Okay, and upon the Israel of God. Now, somebody who has the NIV read.
Galatians 6:15 and 16, New International Version. "Neither circumcision nor circumcision means anything. What counts is a new creation. Peace and mercy to all who follow this rule, even to the Israel of God."
Okay, even to the Israel of God. You notice the difference in the two translations? The difference is this. There's a Greek word kai, sort of you transliterate it, K-A-I, kai. And the word kai can mean also, even, or also or even or and. So the question here is in this verse, is he making a contrast? Okay, is he saying here, peace unto those who follow this rule, and that is that it's a new creation, and to the Israel of God? That's how the New American Standard translated. Or do you translate the word kai even to the Israel of God? I think the appropriate translation is the New International Version translation. And here's the reason. The whole book has been arguing that that the people who trust in Jesus are Abraham's children. They are the Israel of God. And that's why the NIV translation, I think, is appropriate and right. And it just jumps off the page once you start wrestling with these issues. Peace and mercy to all who follow this rule, that is, that what counts as a new creation in Christ, even to the Israel of God. Now, what that really shouts and declares is that those who believe in Jesus are the Israel of God. And so it's not that you have two different lines of work. It's not that God is doing one thing with Israel and another thing with the New Testament church. Not at all. Instead, it's true that what starts with the Old Testament church continues, I mean, Old Testament people of Israel continues with the New Testament church as one line and not two different lines of what God's doing. Does that make sense? So we are the Israel of God if we believe in Jesus. A third passage that really was helpful to me is in John 15. And my bet is when you really begin to understand more about covenant theology, John 15 is going to take on a meaning that you never saw before. I know it did for me. For many, many years, I just thought John 15 is a nice analogy that says just like a branch has to depend upon the vine, I have to depend upon Jesus. There's a lot more theology behind it than that. Let me get somebody to read verses 1 through 8 out of John 15.
John 15, 1 through 8. "I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that bear fruits, he prunes it so that it may bear more fruit. You are already clean because of the word which I have spoken to you. Abide in me, and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit of itself unless it abides in the vine, so neither can you unless you abide in me. I am the vine, you are the branches. He who abides in me, and I in him, he bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. If anyone does not abide in me, he is thrown away as a branch and dries up. And they gather them and cast them into the fire, and they are burned. If you abide in me, and my words abide in you, ask whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. My Father is glorified by this, that you bear much fruit, and so prove to be my disciples.
Jesus, I'm the vine, I'm the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. If you abide in me, if you remain in me, you are like branches. Okay? Now, look back for a moment at Isaiah chapter 5.
Isaiah 5, 1 through 5. Let me sing now for my well-beloved a song of my beloved concerning his vineyard. My well-beloved had a vineyard on a fertile hill. He dug it all around, removed its stones, and planted it with the choicest vine. He built a tower in the middle of it and also hewed out a wine vat in it. Then he expected it to produce good grapes, but it produced only worthless ones. And now, O inhabitants of Jerusalem and men of Judah, judge between me and my vineyard. What more was there to do for my vineyard that I have not done? Why then do I expect it to produce good grapes? Did it produce worthless ones? So now let me tell you what I am going to do with my vineyard. I remove its hedge, and it will be consumed. I will break down its walls, and it will be trampled to the ground.
Okay. In the Old Testament, over and over again, God's vine or God's vineyard is what?
Israel,
that's right. Over and over again, Israel equals God's vine or God's vineyard. You remember the story of the wicked tenants of the vineyard that Jesus told? There's a man that owned a vineyard, and the owner of the vineyard had men working it for him, and he sent his servants to collect, and they killed one servant after another. Finally, he sent his son, and they threw the son outside the vineyard and killed, you know. How did the Pharisees respond to that story? They were very mad, weren't they? They understood very much. At the end of the story there, Jesus says, what's the owner going to do? He's going to take the vineyard away and give it to others. The vineyard there represented Israel, and it represented the kingdom of God. So all the way through, there's this whole vine and vineyard theology of the Old Testament. So when Jesus says in John 15, I'm the true vine, what's he saying? I'm the true Israel. It's just this picture I'd drawn up here a second ago. I'm the true Israel, and those who believe in me are like the branches of the true Israel. So it's much bigger and much broader, much deeper than just this idea of, well, you got to trust in me and rely on me, you know. And, you know, all kinds of wacky theologies come out of John 15 in terms of, you know, the life that abides and, you know, a lot of Keswick theology and stuff of what it means to let go and let God. What Jesus is saying is, if you trust in me, you're part of the new Israel. Now, he's also saying you have to depend upon me to bear fruit. You can't do it in and of yourself. That part is correct and that's true. Your life depends upon me. Your fruitfulness depends upon me. But in a much deeper way, what Jesus is saying is you're part of the real Israel and the true Israel if you trust in me. Now, when I was Baptist, and I did believe in once saved, always saved, and you can't lose your salvation. One part of John 15 that really bugged me, which part do you think bugged me if I believed, if I didn't understand covenant theology, but I did believe once saved, always saved, what verse in John 15 do you think caused me problems? Well, that's right. I mean, I used to really, that bothered me. It sounded like you can lose your salvation. The beautiful thing is this. Once you understand John 15 in light of covenant theology, that verse makes all the sense in the world. What Jesus is saying is this, abide in me and you'll be part of the true Israel that abides. But if you don't follow me, if you don't become a follower of Jesus, you're going to be thrown into the fire and burned. What he's saying is we're having a changing of the old administration of the covenant of grace to the new administration of the covenant of grace. And if you're going to follow me and abide in me and remain in me, you will bear much fruit. But if you don't, you're going to be thrown away. Yeah, they didn't. I mean, they didn't understand who Jesus was as Messiah. But what Jesus is saying is, if you're going to remain a true Israelite, if you're going to remain a true child of Abraham, you have to believe in me. If you do believe in me, you will remain as one of God's vineyard. You'll remain as a part of God's vineyard. But if you don't trust in me, you're going to be thrown away, cast into the fire. Well, there is politically. I mean, there are definitely those who, out of dispensational theology, have pushed our alignment with the nation of Israel with the belief that they are God's chosen people, so we surely should not, you know, oppose them, etc. Of course, there are a lot of other political reasons, you know, to be aligned with Israel. We won't get into that. But, yeah, I mean, you're right. But what Jesus is saying here is once you understand it, it's very astounding. In fact, I had someone tell me once, I've never checked this out, but they have said that somewhere on one of the walls of the temple in Jerusalem at this time, or one of the walls around Jerusalem, I don't remember which one, there was an etching of a vineyard or a vine, you know, and may very well have been that Jesus referred to this as he was walking by. He points to this and says, you know, and all the Israelites knew the vine there on this wall represented Israel as God's vineyard. And he says, you know, I'm the true vine. If you remain in me, you know, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the right word. In other words, Jesus was saying, if you've been an Israelite, you've been part of God's chosen people. But now that I've arrived, you may not be part of God's chosen people in the future if you don't believe in me. The arrival of Jesus as the Messiah was a true crisis for the nation of Israel, because God was changing to the new administration of the covenant, that those who believe in Jesus are going to be the true Israelites. Let me give you another picture of this same thing. Look at Romans. And to me, this is probably the clearest illustration of this covenant theology, and it's very much the same kind of thing. Romans chapter 11. Romans 11, beginning in verse 11. And rather than read the whole thing, let me just summarize what he says here, because it's probably familiar to some of you. In Romans 11, Paul says that the nation of Israel is like an olive tree. Okay? So you've got an olive tree here. I know this looks exactly like an olive tree, doesn't it? You got an olive tree, and you got branches, and this olive tree. Okay? He says, okay, Israel is like an olive tree. Now, what happens, he says here, to the branches that do believe in Jesus? They remain and they bear fruit. What happens, he says in Romans 11, if you sort of scan it through there, what happens to the branches that don't believe in Jesus? They're broken off. The branches that don't believe in Jesus are broken off. Now, we as Gentile believers, we believe in Jesus. What happens to us? We're grafted in. We are like wild olive branches that are grafted in. Folks, that is a picture, that is the picture of covenant theology, and that's the same thing Jesus is saying in John 15. Does that make sense? It always bothered me. He says, thrown into the fire. Same thing he says here. The branches that don't believe in Jesus are the Israelites that don't believe in Jesus, and they're broken off from the olive tree. The olive tree, there's one people of God, not two trees, one tree. Not two peoples of God, one people of God, one tree. And the Jews that don't believe in Jesus are broken off, thrown into the fire, whether it's an olive tree or a vineyard, a vine branch. The ones that do believe in Jesus remain, and we as Gentiles are grafted in. Now, Jay, I don't know if that answers the question, but that's why Jesus uses the word remain in John 15. It's the same image that Paul uses here, but it's a different plant. He uses the olive tree instead of the vine and the vineyard. But it's pretty much the same picture, that the Jews who believe in Jesus remain as a part of that natural olive tree. The ones that don't are broken off, thrown away, thrown into the fire. And we Gentiles are grafted in. Yet we are now part of that one tree. And to me, I don't know about you, but for me, when I think about that picture of things, I just feel awfully privileged that God really does count me as part of His nation, that there is a connection between Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses and me. ethnically, I'm not Jewish. Physically, I'm not Jewish. But spiritually, I'm Jewish. Spiritually, I am more Jewish than people that are, you know, worshiping at the synagogues all over Atlanta today who don't believe in Jesus. God sees me as a Jew. God sees me as a chosen person. I'm part of His Israel. So this is all that whole idea of, is there continuity or discontinuity? All these passages are saying to me that the covenant given to Abraham does belong to New Testament Christians. We inherit his covenant. Well, that's right. That's right. There's a spiritual inheritance here. Yeah, I mean, there's as far as somebody. Yeah, there's only a believing remnant. And that gets into a level of covenant theology we're not prepared to get to today. But there is an aspect, Old and New Testament both, of God's covenant, people being broader than just those who actually are chosen and who believe. And so then in the one sense, those who were Israelites of the Old Testament that didn't really have repentant hearts, there wasn't a true circumcision of the heart, they're not eternally saved and they're not part of God's elect. And yet they were part of that next ring of the size of the kingdom. They're not part of the spiritual heritage, but they are part of national Israel. And in the same way, in some instances, you know, today there are those who are part of Christendom who are not really elect. They're in the visible church, but they're not part of the invisible church. And there's some analogies between those two. But it is true, he's saying here, you know, even in the Old Testament, it's just not a case of those who were physically descendants who are automatically saved. But Terry, I'm glad you pointed that out, because that's a very explicit statement too. Romans 9, 10, 11, all three of these chapters, Paul is trying to say, okay, if election is true, he's talked about it in chapter 8, if election is true, okay, what about Israel? I thought they were the elect. And so sort of like Paul in the book of Romans says, okay, now that I brought up this whole election thing and predestination thing in chapter 8, I need to tell you what the deal is between Israel and the Gentiles. How do we decipher all this? And so that's what he does in chapters 9, 10, and 11. And so it's real clear here that there's continuity between old and new. It's not discontinuity, it's continuity. We do inherit, we do own the covenant given to Abraham. One other passage that was helpful to me along this line was in Acts chapter 15. In Acts 15, you've got the Jerusalem Council going on, and the issue for the Jerusalem Council was, do Gentiles have to become Jews to be Christians? Do they have to accept the whole Mosaic covenant and all the Mosaic laws and dietary laws and et cetera to be followers of Jesus? And the answer is no. And so as you know the story, they conclude that these Gentile converts do not have to be circumcised. But part of the interesting argument begins in verse 14 through verse 18.
Acts 15, 14 through 18. Simeon has related how God first concerned himself about taking from among the Gentiles the people for his name. With this, the words of the prophets agree, just as it is written, after these things I will return, and I will rebuild the temple of David, which has fallen, and I will rebuild the ruins, and I will restore it, so that the rest of mankind may seek the Lord, and all the Gentiles who are called by my name, says the Lord who makes these things known from long ago.
The key thing here is this. They're trying to understand what's going on with the gospel spreading and Samaritans believing in Jesus and Gentiles believing in Jesus. And so here Simon says what's happening is God is rebuilding the fallen house of David. With the coming of the Spirit and the ministry of Jesus, the house of David is being rebuilt. And what's happening? Gentiles are coming into this house. Now, the picture is, with what is happening with Jesus, the house of David is being rebuilt and Gentiles are coming into the house. In other words, there's not another house being built. There's not this house of David that stands for Israel in the Old Testament covenant. And now that Jesus has come, God's going to build a different house for the Gentiles to come in. Okay, here's the house for the Jews. And they're still in God's plan. And here's another house for followers of Jesus, the Gentiles. No. One house. The house of Israel that had been fallen through all of God's judgments. This house of Israel, this house of David is being rebuilt. And when Gentiles believe in Jesus, they're coming into David's house. Do you gather what he's saying here? When Gentiles believe in Jesus, they are entering David's house. They're being welcomed in as family members of King David. And so it's a very powerful way of saying, this is the nation of Israel. This is what's happening. Don't get freaked out that Gentiles are following Jesus. This is exactly what the Old Testament said would happen. The house of David would be rebuilt and Gentiles would come in. And so here again, it's another powerful picture to say what we're dealing with in the New Testament is a powerful continuity. God is not setting aside the Abrahamic covenant. He's not, doing away with the Abrahamic covenant. He is fulfilling the Abrahamic covenant. But Gentiles who believe in Jesus are entering into that very Abrahamic covenant. We are His children. Now, you're saying, Bob, boy, you sure have belabored this point. Well, the reason is everything follows from this. For a long time, I just couldn't buy into infant baptism because I didn't see it explicitly taught in the New Testament. Well, here's the deal. If there is continuity between old and new, I don't have to see things explicitly taught in the New Testament for them to be New Testament practices. Does that make sense? If there is continuity between old and new, I don't have to see something explicitly taught in the New Testament for it to be a New Testament practice. I just need to see it in the Old Testament taught and then to know that it was never abrogated or done away with. And that's a whole nother approach. Okay, where we're told is that the ceremonial parts of the law are done away with because they're fulfilled by Jesus. So, in the Old Testament law, there's civil law that had to do with the nation of Israel and with Israel not being a nation as a political entity any longer. Those do not continue. And then Jesus and the book of Hebrews and other New Testament writers say to us that all of the ceremonial law is done away with, okay, because Jesus fulfilled the ceremonial law. And when I was Baptist, I thought that's what all the circumcision was. Part of my conversion to understand infant baptism and embrace it was my understanding that I never had one Baptist talk to me about this topic that understood circumcision. I can't remember one. I can't remember anybody who understood what circumcision represented. And circumcision was given before the Mosaic Law, 400 years before the Mosaic Law. It was given at the time God chose Abraham and said, I'm going to make a covenant between you and me. It was not part of the Mosaic Law. It preceded the Mosaic Law. And I never understood that. In fact, we'll just jump ahead to a key passage, and that is Romans chapter 4. Romans 4, 11. Paul is dealing here with justification by faith, but he talks about circumcision. And in Romans 4, 11, he's speaking of Abraham, and he says, Abraham received the sign of circumcision. And notice what it was, a seal of the righteousness that he had by faith while he was still uncircumcised. Now, the point here of this is Paul's making the point that he received it as a sign of righteousness through faith, not through works, not through the law. But what jumps off the page to me is that what circumcision represents is righteousness through faith. Okay? So here's the deal. To answer your question, Chris, yeah, there's a lot that is abrogated that doesn't carry over from old to new. All the ceremonial law is abrogated and put aside. But there are other things that do continue. Let me give you another example here. That is the issue of the tithe and the issue of one day in seven being God's day. People that are consistent in their theology who are dispensational do not believe in tithing because it's never taught explicitly in the New Testament. We do believe in tithing. Because it's explicitly taught in the Old Testament, it's pre-Mosaic law, it's not ceremonial law, it's pre-Mosaic, and there's nothing in the New Testament that puts it aside. So we would say our giving needs to be at least a tithe or more. Another issue is one day in seven being the Lord's Day. That is part of the Ten Commandments. It's part of the moral law of the Old Testament, and it also precedes the giving of the Mosaic law. We see it established even in creation itself. God creates in 6 days and rests on the seventh. And so there are things like that that our theology say that continues from old to new. And dispensationalists would say, no, we've got to see it explicitly commanded in the New Testament or we can't embrace it. And our view would be, no, we have to see it explicitly put aside as being part of the ceremonial law or it continues. And so for us as well, the idea here is that if circumcision is a sign of righteousness that comes through faith, then that practice of a child of a believer receiving a sign of righteousness through faith, even before they have faith, should also continue. And if baptism has taken the place of circumcision, and just like the Lord's Supper has taken the place of Passover, then it continues on. I mean, I remember so well, I was wrestling with these issues, and I'd heard people that were covenantal explain their viewpoint, and it just didn't make any sense to me. And then I was reading Romans, and I saw this, and I thought, golly, I never knew circumcision represented righteousness that came through faith. And my very first thought was, wait a minute, it was given to these little bitty boys 8 days old long before they had faith. And my big argument had been, wait a minute, I know that baptism represents cleansing. And I know that cleansing comes through faith in Jesus. And so you can't give baptism to somebody who doesn't yet have faith. End of discussion. That's pretty sound logic, don't you think? Baptism represents cleansing. It comes through faith. You can't give it to somebody until they have faith. And then I saw here in Romans 4:11 that not only did God allow, but God commanded the sign of righteousness through faith to be given to children before they had faith. To the child of a believer, they receive this sign of righteousness through faith long before they personally have faith. And so my biggest, strongest argument against infant baptism withered away in light of Romans 4:11. I just felt so sure. I don't care what they say and what all their arguments are of Old and New Testament. I just know baptism represents cleansing, and cleansing comes through faith in Jesus, so you can't give somebody baptism until they have faith. And then I saw right here in Romans 4, you know, circumcision represents righteousness that comes through faith. And God commanded that it be given to the children of believers long before those children have faith. And so that's when I realized, you know, my arguments have been there because I really haven't understood circumcision. And it amazed me after that, the degree to which I would even talk with, I mean, religion professors and pastors who were Baptist. And it's like Romans 4:11, like they'd never seen it. And I would ask, what do you think circumcision is? What does it mean? What does it represent? I never had any of those people say it represents righteousness that comes through faith. And when I pointed out, it would be like, well, you know, they just sort of stammer around it. Because in their minds, it's all part of the ceremonial law, without understanding that it in fact was given to Abraham, as Bob said, 400 years before the ceremonial law came about. That's right. That's exactly right. Because, I mean, when I was Baptist, I thought about this whole thing very individualistically. I mean, I just thought, oh, golly, I don't know what this whole family connection has to do with anything. I don't understand that. It's every individual. But no, the whole covenantal thing does continue of families being included. And that's another side point here, the whole issue of household baptisms. I can remember when I was still Baptistic having some people point to the household baptisms in the book of Acts, you know. And there's the description of baptizing households. And when I was Baptist, and most Baptists would say, that's, well, then every person in the household must have had faith or else they couldn't have been baptized. But when I was Baptist, a verse that really bothered me was in Acts 16. The Philippian jailer is converted. You know, when he, if you remember the story, the doors of the prison are flung open, and the Philippian jailer thinks, oh no, you know, they've escaped and he's about to kill himself rather than, you know, be found guilty of failing on his duty there. And Paul says, no, don't do that. And it says, believe on the Lord Jesus Christ, you shall be saved, you and your what? Household. Well, when I was Baptist, that really bothered me. How can you say your household will be saved? Well, it's part of the idea of the covenant theology. Like you said, the children, just as in the Old Testament, those children were included in the covenant family, and as they grew up, they then made their own decision to be a covenant keeper or a covenant breaker. It's the very same thing into the New Testament, that our children are included as a covenant, as a part of the covenant family. And as they grow up, just like in the Old Testament, they make their own choice of being a covenant keeper or a covenant breaker. And that's critical and that's important. But yet they are inside the household of faith. That's right. In fact, for me, one of the things that really helped me in this. It's sort of an emotional appeal, but it's an intuitive kind of thing. And that is, for us as Christians, just intuitively, we teach our kids to pray the Lord's Prayer. You know, we teach them to pray and ask for God's provision and God's, you know, guidance and those kinds of things. And if you're really consistent in dispensational theology or Baptist theology, you should never teach your children to pray those things. If you're really consistent, you should never say to a young child who hasn't yet prayed the sinner's prayer to ask God to provide or guide or do anything. They're outside the covenant. And yet, I don't know of any Baptist family that does that. Intuitively, they know I can have my child call upon God as their God to guide and provide and lead. I grew up in a Baptist church that did not do baby dedications. In fact, I don't think I saw a baby. I'm sure I did never saw a baby dedication service in a Baptist church until after I was Presbyterian, and I'd gone to a church in Arkansas for evangelism explosion training, and it was in this big Baptist church. And on the Sunday that I was there for the EE training, they had a service of baby dedications. And I couldn't, after I'd come to embrace covenant theology and infant baptism, I watched these baby dedications. I just felt like standing up and saying, go ahead and put water on them, you know. But, you know, because it's the only thing that was lacking. They were saying just about everything else, you know, this child belongs to God, yada, yada, you know. And I just thought, you know, it really is true. Like I heard somebody say once that baby dedication is the poor man's infant baptism. It's just, you know, just intuitively, there is something that says this child is special and we want to treat this child specially and we want to, you know. And so there really is this sort of an intuitive part of us that says, yeah, we sort of intuitively know that our kids ought to be treated as being under God's protection and guidance and leadership and blessing while they're in our household and while they're, you know, young and have not come to that point of decision on their own yet. And that, I think that intuitive belief and feeling comes from the rightness of covenant theology. Yeah, an explicit passage that ties the two together is two passages. First is Colossians 2:11 and 12. When I was really studying hard on this passage, Colossians 2:11 and 12 is a passage I ended up spending a lot of time in. He says, "They are in Him, that is in Christ. You were also circumcised in the putting off of the sinful nature, not with the circumcision done by the hands of men, but with the circumcision done by Christ, having been buried with Him in baptism and raised with Him through your faith in the power of God who raised Him from the dead." That passage, more explicitly than any other, ties together baptism and circumcision. Okay, when and how was I circumcised? I was circumcised in my baptism. Now, I think what Paul does in Colossians 2:11 and 12 is he basically says, if I can paraphrase here, there's an inward baptism and there's an outward baptism, and there was an inward circumcision and there's an outward circumcision. And in the Old Testament prophets talk about you've been circumcised to the flesh, but you haven't been circumcised in your heart. Okay, so the prophets talk about there's such a thing as an outward circumcision of the body, but missing the boat of an inward circumcision of the heart. The same thing is true on baptism. People could have a physical baptism and not have a baptism of the Spirit in their heart. So in Colossians 2:11 and 12, Paul explicitly puts these two things together and basically says, okay, you think circumcision's a big deal? You are circumcised in Christ. The baptism of the Spirit is the same thing as the circumcision of the heart. Let me say that again. The baptism of the Spirit is the same thing as the circumcision of the heart, and therefore also the outward baptism takes the place of the outward circumcision. So that passage explicitly connects the two, I think, more than any other passage. Another passage that relates to it a little bit is the one we read earlier, Galatians 3, 26 through 29. We looked at that earlier. We'll look at it again just for a second. You are all sons of God through faith in Christ Jesus. For all of you who were baptized into Christ have clothed yourselves with Christ. Therefore, there is neither Jew nor Greek, slave or free, male nor female, for all are one in Christ Jesus. Colossians is a lot more explicit, but at least there's some connection made there. Now that brings the other issue that is a significant issue of this continuity versus discontinuity thing. And that is this. There is a silence in the New Testament on this issue of it being taught explicitly. See, another part that hung me up when I was Baptist was, I mean, I remember arguing with guys and saying, I need to see an explicit passage in the New Testament that explicitly argues for infant baptism or that explicitly gives a slam dunk example of an infant being baptized. And they never could come up with it. And that is where I finally came to believe that the silence of the New Testament is an eloquent silence. Now, what I mean by eloquent silence? Jay Adams' book on baptism alludes to this. In fact, when I end, I want to just sort of point out to you some books that were helpful to me. But I had already, you know, probably like a lot of people had, come to have a lot of confidence in Francis Schaeffer, even when I was Baptist, you know, and started reading his stuff on worldviews. And one of the things that Schaeffer says in here is basically this. Put yourself in the sandals, so to speak, of a Jewish man in, you know, 50 or 60 A.D., and let's say 50 A.D., you hear the Apostle Peter preaching that the Messiah has come, the new covenant prophesied by Jeremiah has arrived, and if you want to be part of the new covenant community, you're to receive the sign of baptism to represent that you're now part of the new covenant community after the Messiah's arrival. Now, being covenantal in my thinking, being Jewish, and he says, come receive the sign of the covenant. Who am I going to bring with me to also receive their sign of the covenant? My children. I mean, it's been the whole way I've thought for all my years, you know. So now imagine if I were to, you know, show up and come up to Peter to be baptized and I've got my children in tow. What would I think if Peter said, wait a minute, no, your children are no longer included? Wow. What do you mean no longer included? And that's when I began to think, when you think about it existentially like that, what you realize, at least what I realized or came to believe is, that if the children of believers were not going to be included in the New Testament, there would have to be explicit teaching for that they're not going to be included. We're going to kick out our kids. That's right. The book of Hebrews says that the New Covenant in the New Testament is a superior covenant to the old. So if it's superior to the old, are my kids going to be kicked out? Are my kids not going to be included? No. If it's superior, my kids are still going to be included. And so just for me, as I begin to think through that, I thought, you know, this issue of the silence of the New Testament is an eloquent silence. And the reason it's eloquent is if children were no longer going to be a part of the covenant community, I tell you what, that would have been a fight. That would have to be explicitly taught. Instead, we see the examples of household baptisms, and we see the silence that I think speaks to the fact that it carries forward. A little bit earlier, I said the things that helped me in my second year of seminary to embrace covenant theology. One was systematic theology and understanding more of this issue of continuity of old to new. The other thing that helped me was church history. And let me interject that now for this reason. Having grown up Baptist in Alabama, I had no idea that the majority report of Christians for 2,000 years was infant baptism. My attitude was that the burden of proof is on these people that baptize infants. No. The burden of proof is on the Baptist. The Baptist is by far the small minority of Christians in 2,000 years of Christianity. And even more so when you study church history and realize that there is without a shadow of a doubt documents that show that in the early part of the second century, children are being baptized. Now, if children are no doubt about it being baptized by the early part of the second century, that means within 30 years of the destruction of Jerusalem and within only 10 or 20 years of the death of the last apostle, children are being baptized. Now, here's the idea. Do rituals like that get perverted in 10 or 20 years that easily? Not at all. I mean, you talk about changes in theology of churches. You want fights. You'd start changing rituals and sacraments in a church. Okay? Now, is it logical to think that Jesus and the apostles taught immersion for believers only, but within 20 years of the death of the last of the apostles, all of a sudden they're baptizing infants? No way. No way. And so for me, another big argument was the argument of church history, that the burden of proof is solidly on the shoulders of the Baptists to have to prove their position, because the argument for church history is overwhelmingly on the side of people that do baptize infants. Right. And there's no doubt that for me as a Baptist, the first thing I had to get over was understanding that there are people like Presbyterians that baptize infants, and it's not just a carryover of Catholicism. I was shocked when I first understood that Catholic theology on infant baptism was not everybody's theology on infant baptism. As a Baptist, I'd been taught that Catholics believe in baptismal regeneration, that the waters of baptism cause a child to be born again. Well, I thought that's what everybody believed, that baptized infants. And so it was just an eye-opener to realize there's a different theology, and this is not a carryover of Catholicism, and it helped me also understand how Catholicism had perverted a lot of true practices of the church, and this is one of them. They perverted the Eucharist. They perverted the Lord's Supper. They have a theology about the Lord's Supper that's absolutely wrong, but the sacrament is a right sacrament. And the same thing in baptism. They perverted the theology of infant baptism, but there's a practice that's right. Probably the pastor I grew up under was probably more scholarly than a lot of guys that pastored small Baptist churches in the South. But still, there just wasn't the depth of the theology of the Old Testament to put it all together and everything. As a Baptist, I was very put off by, you know, the idea you got these kids that were baptized as infants and they think they're secure. But frankly, the longer I went as being in youth ministry in Baptist churches, I saw as just as damnable and just as damaging, maybe even more so, the normal practice in most Baptist churches. You get kids that are 10, 11, 12 years old, and there's a lot of social pressure to walk the aisle and make a public confession of faith and get baptized. And my assessment after being in youth ministry in Baptist churches for a number of years was about half the kids that were in high school were converted, the other half weren't. But all of them could say, well, this is when I walked the aisle and got baptized. And so there was, you know, I mean, there, and the point is there are false rituals on both sides. And yet the falseness on both sides, it can be very, damning. Yeah, it does, very much so. And I think that's another passage that explicitly fits with covenant theology, to say the child of even one believer is holy to the Lord. It doesn't have to be both believers. Even one believer is holy to the Lord. And I think also there's this connection in a lesser way. We can't say that that a spouse of a believer is regenerate or born again.
Right.
But there is some manner in which, in a remote way, that the a person married to a believer, is in at least a position of real privilege to be around the things of God like they are, you know. Well, that's right. You know, the whole household theology thing just fits with this theology and never fit with more of a Baptistic theology. So, well, the good news is, though we've gone a little bit over time here, the good news is all the questions I've raised and all the ways in which I've confused you today, Bob has several more weeks to try to explain, you know, to you more accurately. Well, this is what Cargo was trying to say and missed it a little bit, but I'll try to clarify it. Let me mention a few books that were helpful. This one by Francis Schaeffer was helpful. Probably the best book out on the topic, in my opinion, is Children of the Promise by Robert Booth. This is written by a guy that was Baptistic and then became Reformed, and one of the great things about it is he spends a whole lot of the book establishing covenant theology and then gets into the issue of baptism. And that's why it's a strong book. This book, William the Baptist, has been around a long time, and it's interesting to read because it's sort of a conversation, a running conversation between someone who believes in infant baptism and a Baptist about their questions and that kind of thing. There are a lot of other books up here on covenant theology. I'll just end it with this comment. When I was wrestling with the issue, I went to a professor at Covenant, a professor at Trinity Seminary where I went, and there were professors there that were on both sides of the issue. So I went to an Old Testament professor who I knew did believe in infant baptism, and he gave me this advice, and it was great. He said, anytime you have an objection, theologically or philosophically or whatever, against infant baptism, weigh the same objection against infant circumcision and see what the answer would have been. And that proved to be very, very helpful as I wrestled through it. You know, I would come up with this practical you know, objection or this theological objection or whatever against infant baptism. And when I would stop and weigh that same argument as an argument against infant circumcision, it helped me to understand the paradigm of how the both fit together. And it was very enlightening. That conversation was a real turning point for me to come to embrace infant baptism, because it helped me on my own know how to deal with some objections along the way. So anyway, well, thanks for letting me share my story with you. Bob, you want to say anything else before we close?